14. By 3 p.m. on the 29th of July 2023, Don, Gail, Ian and Heather had all left and the boys had tumbled into the TV computer room. Simon hadn't even left the car when he'd brought the boys home. He and Bronte had just driven off to spend some father-daughter time together. Jack might have spent a few minutes helping put some stuff in the sink, but Erin couldn't really remember. And in terms of leftovers, what was left over? Prompted Colin. Apart from, you know, little scraps of, you know, a bit of pastry or a bean or whatnot, there was the rest of my Wellington and some potato I hadn't eaten, a lot of Heather's fruit platter that she encouraged me to keep, and quite a lot of the cake that Gail had brought was left over as well. She left that. And was there any other portions of beef Wellington left over? Yep, so there was the sixth one, the entire sixth one left over as well. So what happened after that? So Jack and Barnaby went into the study and played on the computers for the rest of the afternoon, and I kept cleaning up the kitchen and putting everything away, and I had a piece of cake. She paused, either for effect or out of embarrassment, it was difficult to say. She looked down for a moment, then pushed her hair back, and then another piece of cake, and then another. How many pieces of cake did you have? All of it, she answered softly. How much had been left? Probably a good 2/3 of it was left. And what happened after you ate the cake? I felt sick. I felt overfull. So I went to the toilets and brought it back up again. Colin had already asked Erin about her body image issues, and she had said they'd been a thing since she was a teenager. Countless girls and women could instantly identify with this. So these feelings weren't new to Erin, Colin reminded us. There's been some evidence about book receipts in relation to diet books. Erin agreed. She'd tried every diet under the sun. She went on to give a quick snapshot of her eating habits over the years. Her mum, she said, used to weigh her daughters every week to make sure they weren't putting on too much weight. So I went to the extreme of barely eating, then to, through my adulthood, going the other way and binging, I suppose, for want of a better word. You say binge eating? Colin inquired sympathetically. Yeah, eating everything you can find your hands on to feel sick, and then bringing it back up again. Erin was struggling to get her words straight. This was awkward to listen to. You could see she felt so exposed. The most shameful part of her life was now being undressed in front of the predatory instincts of international media that had to satisfy a global appetite for any morsel of news about the mushroom lady. And when did you engage in that kind of behaviour? When people weren't around? It was a very private thing. Yeah, you know, kids at school or Simon at work, that sort of thing, when I had the opportunity. And over what period of time did that habit extend? I've been doing that since my 20s. How frequently, on average? I mean, in some intense periods, it could have been daily. Then it could be weekly or monthly. It varied in intensity. And leading up to July of 2023? Oh, maybe 2 or 3 times a week, roughly, on average. Maybe a little more. And who knew about it? Nobody. Nobody. Having previously introduced us in a general sense to the shame she felt about her weight and her body issues, Erin was now telling us that she had been bulimic to some degree with several intense periods over more than 20 years, and no one had suspected anything. Careful, honey, I was thinking. Yes, I felt for her. Particularly if this was all true. But I knew a bit about this. Bulimia is a terrible disease, and people suffering from it can go to extreme lengths to hide their cycles of binging and purging. The tactics employed to maintain the secret can be complex and successful. The urges are intense and the shame is intense. All of these facts have been extensively researched and documented, although everyone's journey is different. But even though she had my sympathy, as a juror, my issue was that we only had Erin's word for it, which was kind of a vicious cycle because if it was true, by definition, we would only have her word for it. On the other hand, given the considerable amount of evidence that we already had in front of us, taking Erin at her word without independent verification was not always a wise move. Time and again, it seemed, if her goals could be reached by getting away with a lie, she'd roll the dice, but not always. She could also tell the truth. If it was true, it would explain a lot. It would explain so much of the behaviour that could only otherwise have been explained by finding her guilty as charged. By the 28th day of the trial, when Nanette was cross-examining Erin, she had already heard the early version of this sad tale and clearly had considered it to be little more than Erin's last-ditch effort to escape a very lengthy jail term. She was questioning Erin over her reply to Simon's text, the one on the Friday night before lunch, when he had said he was too uncomfortable to attend and wouldn't be coming. Nanette began by quoting from Erin's reply to Simon's text. "You wrote, 'It's important to me that you're all there tomorrow and that I can have the conversations that I need to have.'" Erin nodded. "Yes," that's what she had texted back. "Is that a reference to the medical issues that you were confronting?" asked Nanette. "It's a reference to medical things, yes. But you weren't confronting any medical issues, were you? Correct?" Erin blinked. No, I think I was. Nanette paused. I could see her glance quickly at Jane and Sarah. A short, "It's just her word, isn't it?" look. "And what were they?" Nanette asked. Erin just looked, mildly bewildered. Did people seriously think she'd been lying? "I was going to have surgery soon." What the fuck? That was a shock to all of us, to the jury, the media, and Nanette. Nanette was genuinely thrown. "What surgery?" she asked incredulously. "The gastric bypass surgery." Nanette recovered beautifully, but only after a wide-eyed millisecond of panic. "And had that appointment been booked in?" she asked, barely hiding her sarcasm. "I had an appointment for early September, yes," Erin replied confidently. Now Nanette was stunned. This story was real? With who? The Enrich Clinic in Melbourne. When Erin had briefly mentioned earlier that she was planning to have gastric bypass surgery, Colin had just moved on to the next topic, her relationship with Simon, without any questions about it. To us in the jury and the prosecution, it hadn't seemed to be anything more than what she'd said it was, a plan. She might have been genuinely thinking about weight loss surgery, or she might not. But if she had been thinking about it, we all just figured she would look into it at some hazy point in the future. This was the first time the Enrich Clinic had been mentioned. It was the first time the prosecution had ever heard of it, and it was certainly the first time anyone had heard anything about a real, verifiable appointment for surgery. To say it was an interesting moment in the trial is to be guilty of phlegmatic composure in the face of catastrophe. Did all Erin's wishy-washy talk about a medical issue and surgery and needing help with the kids, did this actually have genuinely independent, verifiable substance to it? Well, yes, it looked like it did. In 10 seconds, the entire trial had been turned on its head. Nanette gathered herself beautifully. I watched her closely in those 2 or 3 seconds and I thought, Okay, we know that barristers like you get the big bucks, and I guess this is why. It's worth noting that one thing I'd learned from all the previous legal argy-bargy is that a defence cannot be surprised in this way. To be fair to the accused, a defence must be given everything the prosecution is going to say in advance, so they have time to consider an argument or collect evidence against the allegation. But it doesn't work the other way around. The defence can spring anything they want with no warning at all if they plan it well. They don't have to tell the prosecution a thing. The onus of proof isn't on them. The prosecution can respond, of course, if they have time. But in this case, the defence had no other witnesses, so Nanette was down to the wire. Erin was the last witness in the trial. The prosecution had closed its case. This was it. As soon as Nanette finished cross-examining Erin, all evidence in the trial would be over. There would be no other chance to say or do or ask anything else. I could see a quick exchange between those three smart girls on the prosecution bar table. As per the dictates of court protocol, they stayed totally calm and unemotional. It was the Friday before the June long weekend. They all knew they had a matter of hours to get on to Enrich and figure out what the fuck was going on. Nothing would be open over the long weekend. Nanette's job was to make sure she had enough questions to keep Erin talking for the rest of the day until they got that information, to ensure that her cross-examination continued for another day, because if they got it, then they could ask Erin about it when court resumed on Tuesday. But if Nanette ran out of gas and had to close her cross-examination, it was game over. In the blink of an eye, innocence, not guilt, was suddenly looking like a very reasonable explanation for much of the crucial evidence we'd heard so far.